The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Ascendancy of Babylon, The Life and Times of Rav and the Yeshiva of Sura, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Velvel ben Chaim Alevi Olav HaShalom, Mr. Walter Segaloff, of blessed memory.
Talmud. The very word conjures up an image of a serious and pious scholar bent over a large tome, attempting to fathom the depths of thousands of years of Jewish scholarship. Probably more than any other work, it is the Talmud that kept the hearts and souls of the Jewish people alive, refreshed through the thousands of years of exile and oppression. Over the same folios of text, the 12-year-old child and the 70-year-old scholar come together today to debate and rethink questions that were raised over 1,600 years ago, with the same intensity and enthusiasm of the original Talmudic sages. The ideas, explanations, and questions offered by Rashi, Tosfos, Rambam, and Rashba, great scholars who lived over 700 years ago, together with the thoughts and critiques of later and earlier scholars, form a majestic and irresistibly attractive structure of tremendous wisdom and beauty. It is truly one of the great wonders of the world that a work that is so old and so studied as the Talmud can still be a fertile ground for new insights and new scholarly contributions. New works based on the Talmud are constantly being published, adding to our knowledge and appreciation of this seemingly infinite reservoir of wisdom. Who wrote the Talmud? How did it come into existence? Over the last several lectures, we've studied the origin of the Mishnah, the abbreviated text of the Oral Law. We've seen how from an enormously large work of over 700 orders or volumes, the Oral Law was reduced to 6 and reached its final form under the direction of Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi together with his colleagues and disciples. Naturally, due to the abbreviated nature of the Mishnah, much of the oral law that is contained in the Mishnah is fragmentary at best, is in need of great expansion and explanation. Hence the need for a Talmud, or study. In reality, the Talmud is actually a running commentary on the Mishnah, a commentary that consists of at least 4 parts. The first part is an analysis of the text of the Mishnah. Are there any seeming contradictions between one Mishnah and another? Are there any seeming extra words or phrases in the Mishnah? Are there any word that seems to be missing? This analysis is the first part. Second part is the derivation of the Mishnah. What is the source of the Mishnah? This is the Gemara asked the question, Manolam. Is it based on a verse in the Torah? Or is it Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, part of the oral tradition taught by Moshe, without a clear textual allusion? Or is it based on rabbinic legislation? Is it derived by logic from a different Mishnah, from a different source? The third section is an expansion on the subject matter of the Mishnah, contained in the various brisos or toseftas, which fills in like the missing link, so to speak. Because the Mishnah we have, again, it's 600 reduced to 6, is an outline. Or it comes from other dependable legal traditions, not in a formal Brice or Tosefta, which were preserved by the teachers of the Talmud. And that's the third section, the expansion, bringing in new material. On the Mishnah. In other words, the Mishnah tells you facts A, B, C. But there are other facts that are important to know. D, E, F, G, which are the same family, but fill in and make really the whole structure a lot more complete. So So as we explained before, the brises are by and large material that was left out through the condensation of this Mishnah. Now, when we get from 600 to 6, even though we phrase it very tersely and it's very compact, there's a lot which is really left out. Maybe it's slightly alluded to, but it's really it's left out. This material is all in the brises. The fourth section consists of questions of law not clearly stated in the Mishnah or Brisa. It's in the general subject matter of the, you know, that's related to the Mishnah, but it's a new question. What do we do in this situation? What do we do in that situation? This section of the Talmud contains the great controversies of the Talmudic masters, their logical arguments, the support they bring to their respective positions from the Mishnah or Brisa, early traditions, and of course, the many commentaries and super commentaries subsequently written to explain their debate. This section really constitutes probably the most exciting part of Talmudic study. This is the give and the take. Besides the four legal areas, there exists spread throughout virtually all the tractates of the Talmud, the Agadata. The Agadata is the is really an umbrella term which refers to the biblical commentaries and the ethical or philosophical or traditional traditions of the Talmudic sages that are recorded in the Talmud. And these form really the basis for Jewish belief and philosophy. If we want to know, how are we supposed to view a subject? We look to the Agadata sections of the Talmud. The four legal and other non-legal portions of the Talmud are not neatly separated and divided. They all very often merge together like a movement from a symphonic work. A symphony often begins with a single theme. After the first theme is developed, a second theme begins to intertwine with the first, until it starts to take a personality of its own and develops into an independent theme. But then in the midst of the second theme, musical strains from the first theme waft through the air, begin to merge with the initial theme, in such a way that at times yet a third theme emerges from the combination of the first two. So too the Talmud, using the Mishnah as its base, the Talmud presents the reader with an enormous amount of information meshed together in very much a symphonic style. In actuality, what is happening is that the Talmud is reproducing a classroom situation where the instructor guides his students, answers questions, and very often goes off on a tangent in order to enlighten his class with information that they would normally never be exposed to, only to return to the main subject, perhaps once again to go off on yet another enlightening tangent. So it's as if, really, when you're studying the Talmud, you're really attending a class. At least that's the way I give classes. Yeah. As with studying with a master teacher, the learning experience is at once exhilarating, refreshing, and delightful. This Talmudic approach did not begin with the students of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. It is already mentioned in regards to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the disciple of Hillel, as well as with Hillel. From the Gemara, from the Talmud, it seems that this method of study is as old as the Torah itself. And this form of analysis was always part of the curriculum of the great sages of Israel. In other words, when Yeshua ben Nun, or the other members of his colleagues, the members of the Sanhedrin, or Asniel ben Knaz, when they taught, they went very much in the same form. In other words, they used the basic Mishnayos, the basic facts, and then they went to analyze it, and there was the questions and the answers. The Rambam maintains, and this is he explains the mitzvah derived from the Torah itself, as that there are three parts of learning Torah. There's the Mikra, there's Scripture. There's the Mishnah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, and there's Talmud. There's the analysis. And one is required to devote some time to each one of these sections. Until, of course, one is totally versed with Scripture and totally versed with Mishnah, that one only has to study the Mishnah or Scripture just at, you know, at infrequent times, just for review, and spends his whole time in Talmud in this analysis. But the analysis is very much part, he said, to find that's the mitzvah of the Torah. In other words, the analysis was as old as the Torah itself. Although the Talmud, which we use interchangeably the term Gemara, the analysis and discussions on the Mishnah, we know that they were part of the Yeshiva of Hillel, Rabbi Gamliel. They have not been preserved. Now, there's those discussions as we walk into Rabbi Gamliel's Beis Medrash, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai's Beis Medrash. We don't have, I mean, slightly, but for the most part, we don't have a clear record of the give and take amongst the various sages of the period. However, the discussions on the Mishnah from the Babylonian yeshivas have been well preserved and recorded for posterity. That is the reason why the word Talmud or Gemara usually refers to the Babylonian Talmud, Talmud Babli. We do have a record of the discussions of the yeshivas in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael, the Talmud Yerushalmi, but it's much more sketchy. There's the Talmud Babli that we have was reworked in a form that is more easily accessible. The sentences, are, whole sentences are spelled out. The Talmud Yerushalmi, it seems, because of the political situation, never got its final editing. So what we have basically are notes. And that's why the study of Talmud Yerushalmi is so, so difficult. Because in dealing, instead of dealing as where the Talmud Bavli would spend much more time developing a theme and explaining it, because it was really edited in a way in mind to be preserved for all generations, the Talmud Yerushalmi was basically, we have a sketchy note. So that's why, I mean, also the fact is the Talmud Bavli has been, was produced after the Talmud Yerushalmi. And it's understood that the masters of the Bavli were aware of the opinions of the Yerushalmi, since it is the final word, so to speak, the Talmud Bavli. That's why it's most it's most widely studied, because we base, by and large, our halachas on the Talmud Bavli. It being the latter work, it represented the work of basically all the sages of Israel who came together, because at that time the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, this is, were defunct. This is the time of the final section of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, the time of Rav Ashi. They had already left because of the fact is the Christians made it so difficult for the Jews to remain in Israel. They had fled from Palestine to Babylon, these great scholars, and they, in turn, those who remained, and those of the Palestinian scholars, were involved in the final process of setting the decisions of the Babylonian Talmud. So the Babylonian Talmud represents really the final decisions of the sages. What makes the Talmud, especially the Babylonian Talmud, such an authoritative work, because it represents the last time that we had all the sages of Israel coming together. Because the Talmud Yerushalmi represents this half of the views. The Talmud Bavli, the early years, also represents half the year views, because half the scholars were in Israel and Palestine, half were in Babylon. But eventually, all the scholars eventually left Palestine, moved to Babylon, and in the final years of where the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, is recorded, we have here the discussions of the united sages, and that's why their decisions are really authoritative. But besides the issue of authority, of course, there's just the idea of ease of reading. That's why Talmud Bavli was edited and was meant to be read. Whereas it would seem that the Talmud Yerushalmi was really, it sounded more like private notes, you know, than really a work that was meant to be published and given over and transcribed by various, you know, scribes to be handed all over the world. What the Talmud Bavli is, I mean, if you look at it, is it's the official syllabus of study of the material that was covered in the Babylonian yeshivas while they were in the process of studying the Mishnah. In other words, the question is, this was a standard syllabus. Of course, the teacher, whatever it is, would add on to it and there'd be questions, but this would be the syllabus. They would deal with the initial questions, and further sages afterwards asked more questions, had greater insights. And it grew by layer by layer. In other words, that the later sages' opinions were added on to the earlier sages' opinion, and they became part of the syllabus. So really what we have is layers of discussions of the yeshivas. So it's a really, what we're taking is, it's a, it grew layer by layer till the final years. This was when they studied, this is what they brought up. And as Rav Ashi studied and taught his students, he brought the earlier sages said this, and others disagreed, and maybe Rav Ashi has an opinion, or maybe one of his colleagues has an opinion. And this discussion was really what is recorded of the Talmud. It is as if we'd be hurled through time. When we read through the Talmud, we'd be hurled through time back to the days of the great Babylonian sages, listening to their lectures and taking part in their discussions. Through the various commentaries and insights offered by the great rabbinic minds of the centuries, in a sense, these lectures are still in progress. Because we ourselves, when we study this, we go over it, we ask questions, we look up commentaries, we ourselves offer insights. So the class still goes on. How did Babylon become such a center of Talmudic study? Although Babylon was a major center of Torah from the days of the original exile under Nebuchadnezzar, in the period following the death of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, it grew to such proportions that it eventually eclipsed Palestine as the major center of Torah study. Much of this resurgence of Torah study in Babylon was due to one of the most outstanding figures in Jewish history, Rav. His story is the theme of tonight's lecture. We've discussed in a previous lecture about the various theories of history, the economic theory, the various theories how history has been guided, how events of forces have shaped the flow of history. The approach of the Talmud seems to be close to that we quoted before of Thomas Carlyle. That great people have an enormous role in shaping history. Of course, the Talmud, the Torah's version is that this is all part of Hashem's plan. And he, in a sense, cultivates these people and creates the situations that they should be, he's the conduit, the catalyst that these events and these changes shall take place. The one that we could most clearly point to, and we are going to speak of others, of course, but the most prominent one of that generation who was responsible for creating Babylon to be a center of Torah was one of the most greatest figures of Jewish history, of Jewish scholarship. And in a sense, this person, Rav, was, from early on, seems to have been groomed for this position. It seems he had all the prerequisites. We had discussed in the previous lecture about Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya was the one, together with his sons, great scholars who were already accomplished scholars before they came from Babylon to Palestine. There it's Israel. They were accomplished scholars and made a tremendous difference in the level of scholarship in Israel. Rav was a nephew of Rabbi Chiya. In other words, he was a son of a brother. He was also a son of a sister. You know, from those the it seems that his Rav's, his Rabbi Chiya's father had been married, before. And the so it came out that Rav's mother, unrelated to Rav's father, married. However, Rabbi Chiya was a maternal brother of the mother and a paternal brother of the father. And Rabbi Chiya, as well as Rav, claimed descent all the way back from the family of King David. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, subject of lectures before, claimed their descendancy from King David himself. Rabbi Chiya claimed descent from Shimi, a brother of David HaMelech, of King David. But he was from that general family. It would seem also, Rav, the word Rav means master. We call today someone a Rav. It's an honorific title. His real name is, according to Tosvos, and it seems to Rav Shrira Gaon and Rav Nosson of Rome, so the author of the Oruch, his real name seems to be Abba. And Abba seems to be a name in the family. If you just notice this on the lecture notes, on the bottom of the first page, paragraph C, Rabbi Chiya's father was Abba. It says Avo was Rav's father. And Avu evidently named his son Abba after his father. Rav himself, we know at least of two sons of Rav. One of them's name was Chiya, after his uncle, and one was Avo, after his father. The practice of naming after parents or relatives seems to be quite old. In Mishnaic times, that was the practice. And the Medrash Rabbah even claims that it even goes further than that. In other words, that there's a well-established old practice, which we do today, that we name children after our antecedents, after our ancestors. It seems his name was Abba. He was named after his grandfather. Rabbi Chiya, we know, was a great scholar. Rav Isaac Halevi understands that the passage we have in the beginning of page 2, which referring to Eva, was a student of Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok, one of the great sages who had lived both during the time before the destruction of the temple and much, much after the destruction of the temple. So he came from a family of Torah. He came from a family of Yichus, of a family of stature. And in fact, when Rabbi Chiya would be angry at Rav, or he would, the question he asked is not founded, or I remember when I was in yeshiva, my Rebbe would get angry at me. He would just say, "Gesundheit," and it should be well. He said, "Bar Pachsi," like a son of illustrious ancestors. You're a son of nobility. It's unbecoming a person. You come from such a family. It's unbecoming to make such statements or to ask such questions. But here he had the advantage. And here we're dealing not just the zechusim, the merit that comes from the family, or perhaps the genes or the gifts that come from an illustrious family. But also it makes a difference in terms of a position of leadership. You are automatically invested with a certain aura, a certain chashivas. There's a certain credibility that you have once you come from a prestigious family. It seems also he was blessed with physical attributes, not just the fact that he came from such a family. As we see from the various citations here on page 2, in paragraph G, Rabbi Yochanan made the statement, Rav says, Mishpachas Briyam Hav, I came from a healthy family. There's a question about how much meat does one need to eat regularly. He says he was a healthy person. In paragraph H, we quote the Gemara in Nidan, this is in Chavdalat Amun Beis in 24b, he was a very tall person. And it seems that there's a citation, there's a Gemara in Shabbos in Salik Beis Amud Aleph in 92a, describes Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, a very tall, imposing person. It's an advantage as a leader to be a person of stature. Just again, it invests the person automatically with a certain credibility. Yeah, it's the leader is looking down at all the people, you know, or put it the other way, they all have to look up to him. Huh? He was a man of enormous beauty, of enormous radiance. The Gemara, this is the last citation on page 2, this is in paragraph I, this is taken from Gemara in Bava Metzia and Pei Dalet Amud Aleph in 84a. The text as it reads, and this is in English here, Rav Kahana's beauty is reflection, the original text is of Rabbi Abohu. This is about the beauty of Rabbi Abohu, is a reflection of our father Yaakov, Jacob. Father Yaakov was a reflection of Adam's. In terms of the beauty. There's another text, and this is found also in, from the Gaonim, that it reads, Shufrid Rav Kahana main Shufrid Rav. He says, Rav Kahana's beauty is a reflection of Rav's beauty, Shufrid Rav main Shufrid Rabbi Abohu. He says, and Rav's was a little like, and this is a reflection of Rabbi Abohu. And Rabbi Bo evidently was enormously gifted, like this radiance. But it seems that Rav was also had this tremendous gift. So here already we have a certain bias for success. He was tall. He was imposing. He was healthy. He was bright. He was had radiance, and he came from a very prestigious family. Coupled with all of this was his enormous intellectual talents. He was a student, a very close student of Rabbi Chiya, his uncle. Just one gets a sense of his wisdom here on the bottom of page 3, where we have a fascinating incident. Rav and Rabba Bar Chona, if you saw on the bottom of page 1, we were listing the siblings of Rabbi Chiya. One of them was Hana, Chona. So this Chona also had a son who was a great, just like Avo had Rav, Abba, says, Chona also had an Abba. Evidently, he also named him but he was called Rabba. And so Rabba is a short form of Rav Abba. So instead of Rav Abba, they called him Rabba. They both have to go down from Israel to Babel, and they wanted to have, as scholars, there was no need. While they were in Israel, it was full of many great judges and scholars. When they were going down to Babylon, or at least that area of Babylon, which is close to Israel, and there was a lack of scholars, They wanted to be invested with ordination that they could rule on matters in the absence of other scholars. And there was really no need while they were together with Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, with the Sanhedrin, with the yeshiva. There were many great scholars. But where they were leaving was important for them to have this ordination, and therefore they would be able to exercise their power in matters of Jewish law. Rabbi Chia asked, as a present to Rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, to give smicha, this ordination, to both of them, Rabbi Bar Chana and Rav, two cousins. The ordination that he asked for was for three different subjects, for three different areas he wanted in power. One was the normative, which was to be a dayan, to be a judge. And he granted it to both of them. He asked that they have the right to rule in issues of iser v'heter, in other words, that which is prohibited, that which is allowed, and as much as a rabbi today would, you know, deal with kashrus and related issues. He gave him permission, both of them. He asked for his two nephews, he asked that they be given the right to rule regarding the laws of Bechor. A Bechor is a newborn. We're familiar with a newborn child, with a pigeon aben. It's part of our, this is part of Jewish life. But in those days, it was very much also part of Jewish life, a newborn animal. A newborn cow or sheep or goat, which really could not, in the times of the temple, one would bring it up to the temple. Now there's no temple. You can't do anything with it, but you can't work with it. You can't slaughter it unless it develops a blemish. That blemish has to be certified by someone competent. Evidently they had both Rabbi Bar Chana, the two cousins, and Rabbi studied the subject. He asked that they give smicha, this ordination, to both. To Rabbi Bar Chana he gave ordination to be able to rule on matters of the firstborn, of the Bechor, if it's considered blemished and therefore it could be eaten, slaughtered. To Rav, he refused to give the ordination. And this is the Gemara asked the question, why is this so? Especially in the light, if we see on the bottom of page 3, this is taken from Gemara in Sanhedrin and Hayamid Aleph and 5a. Says he called him Ben Achoisi, the son of my sister, even though he was also the son of his brother. And he meant not only the physical relations, but there's a verse in Proverbs. This is Emor L'chochma Achoisiat. Say unto wisdom, thou art my sister. And this one has to be intimate with wisdom, with Torah. Says, this person is a son of my sister, he's a son of the Torah. In other words, he's a Ben Torah. He said it in such a way that he is a prominent scholar. It seems at this point, as we'll see later on, this point in Rav's life, he had studied with Rebbe, but he was not intimate, and Rebbe really didn't know him. He knew Rebbe Chia, but he didn't know Rav. And he went on. However, says, if in the light that he was such a scholar, why was he not given, says, the smicha? This ordination. And the Gemara really gives two answers to this. One, despite the fact Rav wasn't just merely a familiar with it in terms of book learning, but he had done an internship. He went 18 months, he went to a farm, as he went to a, with a shepherd. And he looked constantly, he was familiar with the animals, which blemishes, the problem with blemishes, some will automatically heal, and some are not healable. That which will heal eventually, it's not considered a true blemish, and one would have to wait till he gets something which is irreversible. How does one know what blemishes are reversible, irreversible? So one could do it through book learning, but one could do it through an internship, through being there on. He went imagine a yeshiva bacher going 18 months. This is Rav. Rav went 18 months you know, to a farm, you know, to a shepherd to learn this. So he was eminently qualified to give him this ordination. And he did it not to get ordination. He did it just to study, because at that point he didn't get an ordination. Why wasn't he given it? So it offers two reasons. One is that since he was superior to Rabba Bar Chana, if they would be both being given the same ordination, and they would see, it would be he'd shine over the, people wouldn't look at him. His cousin, Rabba Bar Chana, they'd only look at Rav. You know, he's the good. They have the both piece, same piece of paper, but if the piece of paper that Rabba Bar Chana has more in it, and he's given more power, then people say, this one really, I don't see it, but he really must be good also. So in order that his cousin should be given his rightful place, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, in his wisdom, gave more power to his cousin who was inferior to him, in order to compensate for the fact that if they would have been given the same, people would naturally have gravitated to Rav and would have not given Rabba Bar Chana, his cousin, the proper respect. Very fascinating. The other was, which is also fascinating, the other explanation is that Rav was too good. There are many situations that one has to determine what blemish will recover or not recover, that one really only could say on the basis of tremendous experience and knowledge. A layman would never know this. The fear would be that Rav, rightfully, would rule on a certain blemish as it's irreversible. And that blemish looks just like another kind of blemish which is reversible. People wouldn't know the difference. And people will say, well, Rav ruled on this one, blemish A, yesterday. And then he leaves, he goes away. And this blemish B, it looks almost to be just the same. And they will wrongfully make the, you know, will come to the conclusion, well, B is just as good as A. Well, if A, it's considered irreversible blemish, and therefore the animal could be slaughtered, B also. So, Rabba Bar Chana did not know it that well. So therefore, A looks like B, he really didn't know. So these gray areas, in other words, Rabba Bar Chana would say, nah, it's not, he's not sure, and therefore he says, no, you have to wait till it gets another kind of a blemish. Rav, in his wisdom, will say, well, no, this blemish is fine. People won't understand why this is so. People will make the wrong conclusion, and therefore he was reluctant to give Rav the power of doing so because of what could come out. Like, he was too sharp, he was too good at this. Whereas Rabba Bar Chana, he was certain that there would be these kinds of situations would never come up. Which is such a fascinating insight into the wisdom of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and why, at least, he would not give this ordination to him. Eventually, and it seems this is taken from the Yerushalmi and Sota, eventually Rav, as well as from we find from other situations, Rabba Bar Chana came back to Palestine from their trip to Babylon, and they continued studying under Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. It would seem in this period, this latter period, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi really got to know Rav and became very close to him. As it seems from other sources, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was not his only teacher. Before we discussed that he studied under Rabbi Chiya, he also studied under some of the great minds of the previous generation. He says, Rav said, I studied this law from Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon. This is Rabbi Elazar, who was together with his father, Rabbi Shimon, in the cave, who was considered one of the great stars of that generation. Rav evidently had arrived in Babylon. This is while he was still alive. It seems also that he had viewed or had a contact with Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yossi, or Elazar ben the son of Rabbi Yossi, again, a son of the greats of the previous generation. These were Rabbi Yossi as well as Rabbi Shimon, were the disciples of Rabbi Akiva. He had contact with, not just with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, but it seems Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's relationship to him was very close. Rabbi Yochanan, and this is on two different occasions, he commented about what kind of a person Rav was. Rabbi Yochanan, as was a subject in a subsequent lecture, was the greatest Rosh Yeshiva in Palestine. In fact, the Talmud Yerushalmi is based on, even though it's really the product of his disciples, but it's based on the syllabus of study that was created by Rabbi Yochanan and his yeshiva. That's why what's meant by that when we say that Rabbi Yochanan is the author of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Not that he's a true author, I mean, much of it comes from later, but he really created the form that was added to it. Describing who he was, Rabbi Yochanan spoke to Reish Lakish, his colleague, and he says, and Reish Lakish didn't remember who Rav was. Rav is, because really his name at that time wasn't Rav, it was Abba. Right? You know, Rav is an honorific title, the master. But they were discussing an opinion of Rav, who was a rabbi from Bavel, says, who's this Rav? I don't know him. Rabbi Yochanan says, don't you remember? He says, that disciple of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who attended the lecture of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Chiya, in all the years which the disciple sat before his teachers, I remained standing. In other words, the privileged students like sat before the Rebbe. Those who weren't privileged like stood like in the back row. So he says he was always sitting. You know, and you think, what did he excel in? He excels in everything. In other words, there's no area of Torah that he didn't excel in. This is Rabbi Yochanan just, is minded, and this goes back many, many years. And as when Rabbi Yochanan already was a Rosh Hashiva, this is reminiscing of things that happened 50 years before. In a different occasion, this is evidently sometime after Rav had originally came to Babylon. And he asked, who's the head of the academy in Babylon? And he says, and the person replied, Abba Aricha. Abba is his name. He said, Aricha means long, tall. It's really not it's a way of expressing, you know, which Abba, it's the tall Abba, you know, but it's not a way, you know, it's, when you're a bunch of yeshiva bachurim, you could call them, you know, there's two Abbas in the yeshiva, the Hecha Abba, you know, there's the tall one. But for a man of great prestige, that's not way to call a person. So he says, you call Rabbi Yochanan, says, this is what you call him? Abba Aricha, was the tall Abba. He says, I remember, again reminiscing as he was a young boy, when I was sitting before Rebbe, to 17, evidently by that time he got a seat, 17 rows behind Rav. Now this is how, seeing sparks of fire leaping from the mouth of Rebbe to the mouth of Rav, and from the mouth of Rav to the mouth of Rebbe. I mean, it seemed like sparks. And I couldn't understand what they were saying. And you call him Abba Aricha. And as such a person, you call him just tall Abba. He was a person that was on a level way above the other students. He was you know, close to the level of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi himself. So here we're dealing again with a person, a mental giant, intellectual giant, who had studied by the great masters of the time. Who eventually, even though it seems when he first got the ordination was not really known, you know, by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he had to tell him who they were, but eventually got to know him, became very close to him. Eventually he rose to a position, on top of page 6, he was a member of his Sanhedrin. In other words, when they voted in terms of legal decisions, so he was a member of that, of his group. He was the smallest of that group, because that group evidently contained colleagues of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, you know, people much older than Rav. But he at least had got the schus, the merit of being part of that group. And it seems he was a person, as it seems from the Gemara in Beitza and Chavdalam and Beis and 24b, who is constantly in the yeshiva, constantly there and listening to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So before we get into how Rav impacted on Babylon, we just get a picture of who Rav was, a man of a very prestigious family who had all the physical, at least, milos, the physical enhancements that would add to his position of being a person to be mashpia, to give to lift the whole level of the generation, because naturally people would just respect him by looking at him. He was an intellectual giant, a person who had studied by the greatest of the generation, and at least the basis now was set for what he would do would be the great influence and the great impact he would have on Jewish history. How did he come to Babel? Unless he was in Israel, after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died, he stayed there. He was still a student, he was a teacher. What made him go back home? And the Talmud tells a fascinating story. This story seems to have taken place at the end of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's life. Rav was giving a class. In other words, he was giving a seminar. And the greats were there listening to Rav. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was in the audience, I guess, with other colleagues and disciples. And he was expounding on a portion of the Torah, of the Bible. And Rabbi Chiya entered. So he had started, so in deference to Rabbi Chiya's uncle, he started from the beginning. Bar Kappor entered. Bar Kappor was one of the great disciples of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Okay, for Bar Kappor, he started again from the beginning. As he was going along, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rabbi, entered. In deference to Rabbi Shimon, he starts from the beginning. Then Rabbi Hanina comes in. Rabbi Hanina, as was the subject of last week's lecture, also one of the great disciples of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He was the one who was named to be the Rosh Hashiva, the head of the academy after the death of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He came in, and Rav says, "Shain genug, how many times do I have to go over this thing again?" So he didn't. And he kept on going, and he didn't. As a sign of respect for Rabbi Hanina, he did not go back to the... And there was a rift, there was a break between the relations between Rav and Rabbi Hanina. Rav went to him on Yom Kippur to ask his forgiveness, right before Yom Kippur, to ask his forgiveness. He didn't give it to him. He came for 13 Erev Yom Kippur's, and that's 13 times he came on different occasions the day before Yom Kippur to ask them forgiveness, and he didn't give it to him. So the Gemara asked the question, how could that be so? You're not supposed to act like that. First of all, why did Rav see it necessary to go 13 times? The most is you have to go 3 times. If they don't ask you for forgiveness 3 times, okay, so the Rav went lefni mishur sadin. He did what he didn't have to do. He went beyond the call of duty. But the Gemara asked the question, what of Rabbi Hanina? Why didn't he give for, you're supposed to, especially a person asked for forgiveness, you're supposed to be mavra al midosav. You're supposed to go and forgive. And go beyond the constraints of your anger and to give forgive. And the Gemara answers, it was an amazing story. Rabbi Hanina had a dream. Evidence goes before Yom Kippur. Rabbi Hanina had a dream that Rav was being hanged on a palm tree. And he saw a picture of a palm tree, and Rav is hanging from the palm tree. And there's a tradition that one who has the meaning of that dream is that person will be the head of the yeshiva. And that's the symbolism of the dream. It was a prophetic dream. So he figures like this. Rav is going to become the head of the yeshiva. Rabbi Hanina, Evidently, this story happened right before Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's death. Rabbi Hanina was given the position to be Rosh Yeshiva. That's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's last will and testament, to make him Rosh Yeshiva. Okay, he deferred in favor of Rabbi Ephes, who was 2.5 years older than he. But he knew eventually, if Rabbi the Tzaddik says he's going to be Rosh Yeshiva, he's going to be Rosh Yeshiva. Now, if this Rav is going to be Rosh Yeshiva, you know, it's like this town ain't big enough for both of us. You know, something's got to go. So even though Rabbi Hanina, because of Rav's prophecy, so to speak, his last will and testament, is definitely going to become Rosh Yeshiva. Goes without saying. But for how long? I mean, Rav's eventually going to get the job. He says, I got to get this man out of here into a different country. So I'm going to make it eng for him. And I'm going to make it difficult that he's not going to feel comfortable here. And he'll want to leave. Well, if he's going to leave, he'll be Rosh Yeshiva someplace else, and I'll be here as long, you know, as the good Lord wants me to. He says, but there won't be any rush to push me out. And that was his rationale. And that's why he made it, you know, that even though he came, so the relations were strained. Rabbi Hanina was, you know, except for Rabbi Ephes, who probably slightly inferior to Rabbi Hanina, he had the official position. Rabbi Hanina was the greatest scholar of the time, and was being groomed, of course, to take over eventually Rabbi Ephes' position. Rav saw that as Rabbi Hanina is the head and the relations are strained, you know, that he doesn't have a future there. And that's why he eventually left. It took him time, but he eventually left. Just to give you the year, the dating here, and we're going to get to it soon, but just to give you a sense, if you have the timeline, as we had before, just to give you the sense of the timing, we have the death of Rav Shmuel Gamliel approximately the year 169. At that time, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi got the position of patriarch. Marcus Aurelius arrived in the year 175. At that time, he formed a friendship with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and the political climate became such that it was conducive to create the Mishnah, and all the scholars would be able to come together unimpeded, just as by the authorities. Even though Marcus Aurelius died in the year 180, it seems that the good will that was created by then continued on with Marcus Aurelius' son Commodus. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and Commodus both died, it seems, in the year 192. The end, it was towards the end of the year 192. We know these 13 Yom Kippurim, those the 13 would happen subsequently. At that time, evidently, he tried, and it was strained. But Rav, it seems, eventually only departed to Babylon in the year 219. This is according to the Igeres of Shriragon, according to the letter of Shriragon. So there was some time that he was there. We are now in the year 219. Rav has decided that perhaps it would be best to go back where he came. The Gemara describes in Shabbos, this is very briefly, a fascinating story, that Rav came from Babel, from Israel to Babel, to Babylon. The two of the great scholars of the time were Shmuel, the subject of next week's lecture, and Karna, who was a contemporary, a colleague of Shmuel. On Rav's arrival, and it describes that he had certain knowledge, evidently, Shmuel, that Rav had stomach disorder,
according to the Rabbeinu Hananel, is it seems the water itself was very turgid. It would be like Montezuma's revenge. It would cause sickness for someone who's not used to it, being the Nebuchadnezzar's revenge. He knew he suffered from stomach problems, but he didn't know what kind of a scholar he was either. And he asked Karna to go and to speak to him in learning. He didn't know Rav intimately. After his Rav was a scholar of Palestine, Shmuel was a scholar of Babylon. They didn't have that much, you know, closeness, especially since Rav didn't have a real position of power. He wouldn't have heard of him, you know, really firsthand. Maybe the name of the Rosh Yeshiva they would have heard from Babylon. They wouldn't have heard of the second tier scholars. Rav, it seems in his personality here from this thing, was in a certain sense, as we're going to see later in the lecture about Shmuel, was similar in a certain sense to Shammai. Notice he didn't have patience with people that he felt were did not live up to the standards he felt were to be lived up to. During this time, we've touched upon in other lectures, there were all kinds of Jews. There were many Jews that that did not show the proper respect of men of learning. We know from other sources, there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin Chabdalat Amid Aleph in 24a, the scholars of Babylon didn't get along with each other. We know from other sources there was a lot of competition. And he felt that he was not treated correctly by Karna, the way he spoke to him. In addition, Shmuel, who was, besides being a great scholar, was a doctor, and gave him, he prescribed for him, actually he gave him to eat. He didn't tell him he was a doctor, he's giving him prescription. As he fed him, he came to his home. He gave him barley bread. He gave him, this is fried fish. It was kasa de harsana, so it was flour, which is fried together with fish oil. And he gave him shecher, gave him beer to drink, and he didn't show him to the bathroom. So he gave him all of this, which would cause them to move his bowel, and he didn't show him. So he had to keep it in. This was all part of the medicinal treatment. Rav interpreted this was a way that he's playing a practical joke on him. And knowing that at least there were others that were of that ilk, that would just, that did not show the proper respect to people of stature, he cursed Shmuel. And he says, "He who causes me pain, may no sons arise from him. He's not worthy of having children." And Shmuel did not have any sons, at least during his life. As long as Rav lived, Shmuel did not have any sons because of that curse. Later on, of course, Rav found out it was unfounded, and he felt terribly bad. Evidently, it's very difficult to erase a curse. Once it's gone out, it's kishgoga yetzim piashalit, and it's just like once it goes out, it's very hard to bring back. And he tried to compensate for this. And even though Rav was a greater scholar than Shmuel, he always showed Shmuel deference. When they go through a door, Shmuel will be the one to go first. He would always show deference to Shmuel. The truth is, though, that Rav was a much greater scholar than Shmuel. There's only in one area, though, that Shmuel was also a dayan. He had practical experience, including a constant practical experience. And when it comes to dine momentous, when it comes to matters of practical legal decisions, we rule in favor of Shmuel against Rav. Because he was in that area at superiority by virtue of his tremendous experience. But overall, Rav was the superior of the two. The Rosh Yeshiva at the time, when Rav came from Palestine to Babylon, was Rav Shilo. When Rav Shilo passed away, And if you see, he says that we, on page 11, you can see that Rosh Hashanah passed away. There was a problem as who was going to now become Rosh Hashiva. Even though this is not recorded in the Talmud, this is part of the traditions that were maintained in the yeshivas of Babylon. It's because the fact that Shmuel was not comfortable, the fact that he should become Rosh Hashiva when Rav is here, he's superior. On the other hand, Rav did not want to be the head while Shmuel was here. This was his hometown. The place of Babylon that he came to originally was Nahar Dor. Nahar Dor was the center of Jewish life in Babylon. In fact, Josephus speaks about Nahar Dor as a great center of Jewry, that they used to gather their half shekels to send to the temple. They used to come accompanied with an armed guard of some tens of thousands of armed Jews to accompany the monies from the machza shekel, from the half shekel. It says there was a tremendous amount of wealth that was coming, and if these are just tens of thousands, you can imagine how many people were in Nahar Dor, at least the surrounding area. That was Nahar Dor, was the center of Jewish life. Shmuel came from Nahar Dor. He didn't feel right that he should eclipse and was this the person who had lived here all his life. And he didn't feel, Shrav did not feel comfortable taking the position where Shmuel was here. So Rav decided to leave. And Rav left Nahar Dor and went to an area, this is this place of Sura, which was not a place, there were Jews there, but there were no Torah scholars there. There was a tremendous ignorance of Torah in this, like the hinterland. For one instance, this is what existed here in the bottom of page 11. Because Rav once happened, he came to Tatelfush, that was the name of the village or town or city, and overheard a woman asking her neighbor how much milk is required for cooking a rib of meat. It's a riba is a certain measure of meat. In other words, how much milk do you need to cook the meat? And she was not familiar with the laws of basar v'chola. There's a milk of meat, which is just so basic to Jewish life. And Rav says, if the people here don't even know the basic laws, he evidently put a law that even something which is allowed by the Torah, which is the milk of the udder of a slaughtered animal, which is not milk, which is milk from a live cow, which there are leniencies of that milk, but he felt that he had to, when he made rulings, he dealt with that equally severe, and they dealt with this severity of all, as regular milk and meat, because the people have to be trained the idea of milk and meat. Since it was foreign to them, or at least to many people, because once we give, we make compromises, this yes and this no, then the whole structure will not be able to stand. So he just said, it's all milk and meat without distinction. But this would give you a sense of what kind of people were there. Rav Isaac HaLevi suggests that the reason there was such poor scholarship in that area is he quotes, there's in the 18th book, the book of Josephus, in the ninth chapter, describes the story, I think, which we have discussed in the previous, a few years ago in a previous lecture, about how two brothers, Anisius and Analeos, originally from Nahar Dor, created a robber band, something like Robin Hood. But it wasn't just a few of his band, but it was a whole army. And they took to robbery, to brigandry. They were fighting with the Parthian army. And for 15 years, they were a law unto themselves. And this is just similar, basically, is that these, you know, in the hinterland of some of these countries like Burma or other areas, that these independent armies are really are a law unto themselves. This is the way it was there. There was a tremendous animosity developed from the non-Jewish population to the Jews, especially when this Jewish group started attacking non-Jews and pillaging them. Eventually, this group was defeated, even though they lasted over 15 years. They were eventually defeated. And as a result, the non-Jewish population wanted to take revenge against the Jews. So those who weren't living in the heavily populated area like Nahar Doa, which was highly fortified, so all the Jews in the outlying villages, and this occurred approximately in the year 40 of the Common Era, or at least when Josephus deals with the year 40, 41 of the Common Era, in Roman history, then he discusses this chapter of history in Babylon. So it occurred, we don't have the exact dates, but it occurred approximately during this period. The Jews in the surrounding evacuated the whole area and ran to the city of Seleucus. Seleucus, which is on the Tigris, there's two rivers in the Euphrates and the Tigris, Nahar Doa was on the Euphrates. So this is, they're going to the east, to the Tigris, was a major city. And for 5 years, the Jews lived in relative peace. But there was tremendous politics there between the Syrian population in Seleucus and the Greek population. The Jews sided with the Syrians against the Greeks for 5 years. The alliance shifted, and the Greeks now allied themselves with the Syrians against the Jews, and they created a pogrom, which was not atypical of the time. We've discussed in previous lectures the pogroms that took place during the destruction of the Second Temple amongst the various Jewish settlements. 50,000 Jews were slaughtered. There's these Jews who settled in Seleucus. So the whole population was killed. Those who managed to escape went to Ctesiphon, which was one of the capitals of the Persian Parthian Empire. It was the winter palace of the Parthian king. It was across the Tigris. They ran for their lives. And eventually they resettled. Because of fear, they all went to Nahar Doa. So it seems that besides the area of Nahar Doa, that place was depopulated of Jews. First they fled to Seleucus. Then after 5 years after Seleucus was destroyed, they first went to Ctesiphon. And then they packed their bags, went back to the Euphrates and went to Nahar Doa. So the outlying area, because of the anti-Semitism, was bereft of Jews. Eventually, years later, in the time of Trajan, in the year 116, Trajan came to Seleucus and slaughtered the whole population, destroyed the whole city. It would seem after this, the changes, and after Greek population was killed out, it would seem the Jews started resettling the area. But the kind of Jews who started resettling the area, as a new area, was without rabbinic leadership. Very often how immigrants start settling areas, how they start settling America. They come for economic opportunity, but it takes years later until the established organizations come and rabbis come and yeshivas. So this land was much the hinterland. But this is where Rav decided to create Torah. And he created it a true place of Torah. Fortunate event occurred that an area near the place where he decided should be his base medrash, should be these things, was owned by a Jewish convert who died without heirs, without children. And he took over that property, Rav, and he made it the garden. It looked prestigious. In other words, you had next to the yeshiva, you had this whole garden, which also provided some food, it seems, for the yeshiva. It also became now not only just a yeshiva, but a beis din. After this, Rav had smicha. As Rav was learned, at least, in the laws of it. He wasn't the equal of Shmuel, but he was a great, great scholar. He created a court of law. That was known as the great court, was Rav's court. So we had, what we created was two centers of Jewish life now. One, Nahar Doa, the ancient center, and Sura, the new center created by Rav. And it became not just a yeshiva, and this is Rav Isaac Halevi points out, but it became eventually a mesifta, Well, the difference between called the Masifta and a regular yeshiva. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was called Reish Masifta. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died, he gave that title to his son Gamliel. The Masifta was very much a yeshiva like a Sanhedrin. They had great scholars, like it was, I believe some of it would be like 70 scholars, there was great scholars, and they're great. It was patterned after the original Sanhedrin of Yerushalayim. So it wasn't just a yeshiva. Originally, Rav was just called Reish Sidra the Bavel, the head of the yeshiva of Bavel. Just like Rav Shila was called Reish Sidra the Bavel, that was his title. The head of the Seder, the order of Bavel. But eventually, and it would seem after the death, this is the story of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, the grandson of Rebbe, that the level of scholarship had gone down. In other words, that generation, Rav's colleagues had died. So Rav really was in a sense, the equal or better of anyone in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael. It was at this time he created, became not just a yeshiva, but a masifta. And the masifta, it seems, and it's not sure, we can only theorize, had much, the idea that they went through the Shas, in other words, every some 30 years, every 6 months, they went through a tractate, and all the great scholars would come together, not just, it wouldn't just be a yeshiva with disciples, colleagues would come, he would be the first among equals, but the great scholars would come together, and they would review everything, and fix the, what would be called the syllabus of the Talmud. And this all happened during Rav's tenure. In fact, Rabbi Yochanan eventually became the Rosh Hashiva and looked to Rav as his Rebbe. When he would refer to him, he would call him Rabbeinu Shebabovel, our master in Babylon. It probably was very helpful as well during the time that Rav had a close connection to a non-Jew by the name of our text is Adrachon. There are those who claim that correct Shev should be Artabon. Artabon was a name which was common to the Parthian kings. Whoever this person was, he was a man of evidently great power, and just like Rebbe's connection with Antoninus granted him much political favor, this is Rav's connection with Adrachon or Artabon as well gave him much political favor. And as a result, he was able, his yeshiva was able to flourish. To the extent, as we said, that the two major centers were created and there was a flow from one to the other. In other words, it became learning, in other words, learning became very prestigious. You have two great yeshivas, both yeshivas vied for students, and there was a, people would go from one yeshiva to the other yeshiva and back and forth, and it grew as a result to a great place of learning. When you had people, it attracted. In other words, students who would decide, well, should they go into business or go into a trade, or should they put it off and study Torah? The study of Torah became so prestigious that more people spend time learning. Even though, again, we said that Babylon was a great center of learning, but probably was more for an elite. And now it became more commonplace that the masses all studied Torah. I would just like to just give you a little insight into the life and the personal life of Rav. Just to think of what we've gone through so far. We went through his life, his family, his own physical bearing, his radiance, his intellectual greatness. We went through the history of how when he came to Bavel, he made the friendship of Shmuel. Eventually he left to go to the hinterland to create his own yeshiva. The yeshiva itself, his yeshiva as well as Nardal, became two great centers of learning patterned after the Sanhedrin itself. They call themselves Masiftas. And it really raised the whole level of Babylonian scholarship. We knew from last week's lecture Rabbi Chiya had a difficult married life. Rav, his nephew, had a difficult wife as well. There's a very cute story which the Gemara in Yevamos brings in Samach Gimel Amud Aleph in 63a. The Rav was constantly tormented by his wife. He would ask for her, "I'd like lentils for supper," she'd give him peas. He'd ask for peas, give him lentils. When his son Chiya grew up, and when he, you know, so he asked, you know, his son Chiya, "Could you ask your mother, I'd like lentils?" So he knew his mother well. So when he went to ask for lentils, he says, you know, Ma, says, you know, Dad would want peas for supper. And you know what she made? Lentils. So he got what he wanted. And after a while, things were going good in the house, you know? Because he didn't speak, he didn't give the orders directly to his wife. He gave them to his son, who we, you know, inverted the order. And one says, you know, your mother really has improved. So he told him the truth. So he says, you know what? It's a great idea, but you shouldn't lie. There's a whole Gemara that deals with the practical advice that he gave, that Rav gave his children. He gave his students and he gave his children. Here on page 14, let's take it from Gemara Pesachim, Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, and then 13a. He says, don't live in a town where there are no horses. You know, the horses don't neigh, says, or dogs bark. It's not safe. There's no security. Don't live in a town where the leader of the community is a physician, because he'll be so busy with his profession, he won't have time to deal with the needs of the community. You know, if they get the beepers go off, you know. It's interesting. One other thing in the end of the second paragraph, Rav. So you can look at all the advice. You don't have time to go through everything. Rav told his son Chiyav, don't take drugs. In other words, don't take medicines which are addictive. He said, don't have a tooth extracted. In other words, if it hurts, try to avoid extraction. Don't provoke serpents, and don't provoke a Syrian, a non-Jew. They have long memories. Because now you could do it, but they could get back, you know. He was a person on page 15 who was reluctant. You know, he didn't enjoy the power that he had. Because when he used to go to court, he says, you know, he says, like, it's such a stupidity. Out of his own will, he's speaking about himself, he goes towards death, you know, because he can make a mistake in judgment. And he's, you know, heaven, you know, divinely he's held responsible. And the wish of his house is out of, and he's leaving his home. You know, what does he get out of this, you know? And he returns empty to his house because he didn't take any money for what he was doing. You know, and he says, halavai, that when I come back, you know, it should be when I come back home, it should be like when I left. And it's without any affairs. I didn't do anything wrong. In other words, at least it would come out that I don't make any mistakes. But he would go with trepidation. The Gemara in Yoma and Pezayin Amrav, this is a great, fascinating story. That Rav once had a complaint against a certain butcher, and the butcher felt had wronged him, and the butcher didn't come to ask forgiveness from Rav, and Rav felt, you know, this Yom Kippur you know, Hashem is going to take this into consideration, and this butcher is going to be judged. So he wanted to attempt to get the butcher to ask for forgiveness. So he went to the butcher, you know, near him, just to, you know, he look at him, maybe the butcher will see him. It's before Yom Kippur, and he says, "I'm sorry, Rabbi." The butcher was standing, as he saw Rav, and he says, "Get out of here. You know, I have nothing to do with you." So he just pushed him away in a very, you know, rough manner. While he was chopping, it was the head of an animal, was, a bone flew off and struck the butcher in the throat and killed him. It describes a story. But Rav went that extra measure. Now, this is a very gruff person. But he wanted to, he didn't want this person to suffer, you know, so he gave him the opportunity to do tshuva. Rav, we have in the top of page 16 in the timeline, according to Shmuel Gaon, died in the year 247 of the Common Era. It's hard to know exactly, you know, how long he lived. You know, this we don't. But it would seem that he came up, and he rose, you know, before the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and he was a person who came up as a scholar already to study with his uncle Rabbi Chiya. So it seems a person he was well into his 80s, 90s. If you just go backwards. From the year 247 to the year 180, for instance. You know, here we're dealing with with almost 70 years. And if he came as an accomplished scholar when he was 20 years old, so he was close to 90. So we don't know exactly, but we can have a sense that he was an elderly person already. He was the the foremost scholar of his generation. Just briefly, you could look at it yourself. The Gaonim have preserved some of the unique qualities of Rav. Qualities that his disciples after him, or disciples' disciples, wanted to emulate. Because of humility, he didn't walk four cubits, cubits a foot and a half, so 6 feet, with an upright stature, sign of arrogance. He was always, his head was slightly lowered. He didn't go without a head covering. On Shabbos, and it says he ate three meals, and he was careful to eat shalashudas. It goes through, he's concentrated when he prayed, and he didn't look around. He didn't just look around in the street or whatever it is, to see things which are not acceptable. He was always very careful. He would avoid, the way that people would stand up for him. In other words, to walk in front of them while they were sitting down. This is a Gemara in Chulin. He didn't want to be invited to meals that were just, meals that were not a sudashel mitzvah, like a pidyon haben or a bris milah. He didn't like the scholars were very careful not to be associated with gluttony, just to be invited to meals and to banquets. He was very careful only if it was a sudas mitzvah. As we read before, if anyone was displeased with this problem that we had before, he would go the extra mile to, the case of the butcher. He constantly would wear tefillin. He had a sweet voice, and he used it. He used to daven. Evidently, this is nothing but from the tradition of the Gaonim. He was a chazan. He used to daven for the Yomid. He was the metargim. In other words, he was the one. When he came to Rav Shila, when he first came to Babylon, Rav Shila was the Rosh Hashiva, and he was in need of an interpreter. And that's how they used to work, was that the Rosh Hashiva used to speak quietly to the Amoira, the interpreter, who had a very loud voice, and the interpreter, a scholar in his own right, would take the words and tell it over to the community, to tell it over to the populace. He did that. These were the things that he was known. They had collected, that he was known. But he had all of these qualities, and evidently it seems that his students or his disciples only had one or two of each. As they're able to be constantly careful on every instant of all was something unique to Rav. But it was his personality and his piety and his genius that was able to make that change. As in Babylon, people were attracted to him. So there was Nardal, people were attracted because it was the mainstay old yeshiva, and Shmuel was a brilliant person in his own right. The new yeshiva in Sura was attracted because of Rav's personality, And as a result, Babylon flourished to be what eventually became as the center of Torah life, you know, for almost 1,000 years. Next week is the last of this series. We'll deal with the life of Shmuel. This is Rav's colleague. Amir Tashem, I'll see you all then. We'll make the annual parting then. And this is open to vent. There are any questions? Yes. I think the Gemara really wants to make a point that physically, that's what seems to be, they were taller than, because it was a bias for success, so to speak, that people would be able to have much more influence. The Gemara speaks about the tremendous height that Moshe had. The tremendous height that Moshe had. Seems to be physical. I mean, of course, it went hand in hand. I guess it's the gift was given. It was all part of God's plan. Because he was such an imposing person, you know, and it was important for him to influence that of his generation. I was told that very often rabbis were chosen in Europe. They looked for someone of height. Again, because of this natural thing of they wanted an imposing person. The question is just why was there a particular fear of Bechor more than in any situation, the firstborn, where there's always this problem. You know, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Hamad Beis in 5b asked the question, what was the necessity of having ordination regarding laws of that which is prohibited or not prohibited? We know the idea of smicha was appointment for judgeships. Okay, you need to be appointed as a judge. A judge is dealing with monetary matters. But for things of Isser v'Heter, and that which is permitted and not permitted, you just need to be an expert. What do you need ordination for? So it tells over a story that a disciple came to Akko. It was like the hinterland, ruled on a subject, and the people totally misinterpreted what he said. And as a result, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi issued an edict. And it says that no one is allowed to give any rulings on Isser v'Heter unless they have smicha, unless they have rishus. They are allowed to do so because I will make sure, says, that not only is he a scholar, but he's careful in how he formulates what he says. And that really is the source of why smicha is given today. The smicha that's given today, as the ordination, is based on this consideration. I mean, so the person is certified not only as a scholar, but a scholar you can rely upon, that the way he's going to formulate his rulings is a way that no problems will arise. But it seems that Bechor, that is such a subtlety, that it's really, you know, it's a difference of, would be millimeters, you know, of a cut or a opening, that things are really more apt for confusion. I mean, that's what it seems. The difference of a wound that will heal and not heal is really something that's very subtle. And Rav, who had so much experience, would deal with millimeters. And something would be off another millimeter, like it's not that wide, and he wouldn't. But people just don't, you know. But it was, you know, they're asking him the Shiloh, you know what I mean? It's not a question of wording it. You know, if you word it this way, that way, is this a mum, not a mum? It's not a mum. It's a mum. Yeah. Right. I mean, in something it's mutter, I'll tell you, this way, I'll phrase it, I'll tell you. This is it. So the farmer sees one thing, and then sees something which is shorter by a few millimeters the next time, you know, or longer, you know. And it's the same thing. You know? I mean, that was really hard to, you couldn't give it up.
I give it up.